Anyway, we have just get some of that busy work out of the way. The Mary Colony, who's one of the heads of the education department, made us aware of she gave us the enrollment key to this class, which is available online. So you can listen, you know, to John Landau teaching Introduction to Tantra. There's all kinds of stuff on the website that's free to the people who are in this class. If you weren't in this class, you'd have to pay like $45 for the enrollment key. But because you're here, you get a discount. So that means you have to come every time. In fact, I wonder if I should do that. Just have if you're not going to come every time, leave now. Just kidding. well, we could do that. We could say, hey, if you're gonna be here every time, stand up. I don't know how many classes I'm going to teach, so to be honest with you, I put a question mark. If I get bored by the end of June, we'll quit. Seriously. I mean, this is a lot of material. It's almost too much. But anyway, so that you can go on the FPMT website and you can download, you can go use the enrollment key Deity Yoga, and I think it would be very cool to do that along with what we discuss here in class, because we don't have much time, you know, an hour and a half is nothing. Not much anyway. Is that hot in here?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm usually cold all the time. I'm all bundled up, so it's like when I get hot. Thank you. So, how many people have been doing Discovering Buddhism? And this is, they've done all 12 modules up till now, and this is like number 13. Hands up high. So there's like 4, 5. How many people are, or 6? How many people are like doing Discovering Buddhism? They kind of came in the middle, and so they want to. This could be your first module. I mean, there's some people that start on module 13 and then end up going all the way back through. I personally think Discovering Buddhism is, probably in some ways one of the most accessible class that we teach, for us beginners, you know, it's really touches on the basic points of meditation practice and Buddhism in general. And those of us that teach it, as I was telling a friend recently, I plan to get way more out of this class than you do. I'm serious. Because it's so interesting to read this, and if you have to teach it, you have to think about it a little bit more, you know. So the teacher always learns more than the students. At least that's my plan. So let's start out with, I think everybody has a prayer book. And you got the foundation of all good qualities, right? That's one of the pages. I hope I didn't make any mistakes when I took it and scrunched it down and tried to put it all on one page. But this is a summary of the entire Buddhist path. Kind of cool. And we'll go over that a little bit tonight. Maybe it won't be an in-depth summary, I promise you that. But let's start out. Turn into the prayer books to the yellow pages, the first yellow page. And we're gonna do a couple of minutes of just being mindful of your breath, and then we'll do Refuge in Bodhicitta in English, and then we'll do kind of jumping around here. So in prayer. Then we'll jump up to the top and do the four measurables. And then we'll do the seven-limb prayer and the short mandala offering. So that's kind of a traditional way of doing the of starting out a teaching. So we're gonna be a little bit traditional in that way. So begin by bringing your attention to your breath. Most people here have some experience with meditation. If you don't, you just bring your awareness to the experience of breathing. Probably the most important aspect of the posture is just sitting up straight. Like your mother said, sit up straight. And you want your back, it's kind of like you're extending your head up to the ceiling. You want that kind of feeling of extension. And you're nice and grounded, so you want both feet flat on the ground if you're sitting in a chair. Not so much leaning back, but sitting up straight. Most people have some notion of the term enlightenment. sounds pretty good, enlightenment. And maybe, you know, the pedestrian, I'm not sure what the pedestrian mentality is about what enlightenment is, but from the Buddhist perspective, there's only one reason to get enlightened, and that is to be a perfect servant for others. And in essence, the whole purpose of the Dharma is to train us to be in service to others. But not just in service, perfect service. Knowing exactly what to say and do in every conceivable situation to help people experience their true nature, to evolve spiritually, to grow, to sort of become the best they can be. So that's the real work of a Buddha, is to guide others from their present state of confusion to supreme enlightenment. That sounds pretty unreachable, doesn't it? Sounds like, wow, I could never do that. Well, that's exactly where Tantra comes in, the practice of Tantra. And we'll talk about it quite a bit. But we have this huge spiritual inferiority complex where we don't think. We have a story after story. We've written, you know, a library of novels about ourselves and who we think we are and our limitations and this and that and on and on. And it's all made up. It's not the truth. But they're limiting beliefs, and they hold us back from finding any true lasting happiness. Impossible. With the kind of minds we have, no way are we going to find any peace and happiness. We'll sabotage ourselves every time. Because we don't feel worthy, we're not good enough, we're not smart enough, we're not handsome enough, we're not this, we're not that. We always have self-limiting beliefs about ourselves. But in Tantra, we practice being a Buddha now. Something kind of amazing. But it's totally based on a correct view of reality and genuine love and compassion. And it's based on some sense of our true nature, our Buddha nature, our essence. So it's not totally fabricated. We're actually contacting our essential nature and then helping it to grow, but grow really fast, much faster than it does in the other aspects of sutra methods of Buddhism. But we can never leave behind the fundamental aspects of the Dharma. The bodhicitta, renunciation, correct view of emptiness, those three principal aspects of the path, that's the basic foundation of effective tantric practice. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk a lot about that. And some tonight and some each night. So the most important meditation that we'll do tonight has to do with developing this awakening mind of bodhicitta. And so one of the ways we can think about this is to think, you know, everybody in here, these are real people, and they're just like I am. Most of us don't know one another, and yet we all want the same thing. We all want to be happy. And none of us want to suffer. And if there are any insects in here, I promise you, if there's a cockroach in here and you try to smush it, it'll run away from you because it doesn't want to die. You know? Every living being wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. We're all the same in wanting happiness and not wanting to suffer. Think about that. And then we contemplate the faults of selfishness, so-called self-cherishing, egocentricity, clinging to this false sense of self. It's just self-cherishing selfishness is the easiest way to think about it. From the Buddhist perspective, that is the devil. If there was a devil, it's that. And it lives right in our hearts. It's that self-centered, I'm the most important one, I'm the center of the universe. Everything is, you know, it's all about me. It's all about me. If it makes me happy, I want more of it. And if it makes me unhappy, I want to push it away. Attachment, aversion, all day long, like that. Self-cherishing selfishness. So much suffering. In fact, the Buddha says all the suffering from the beginning of beginningless time up until this very moment is the fault of one demon. Self-cherishing selfishness. So worth getting to know that and then learning how to uproot it and finally eliminating it completely from our mind stream. And the cause of all happiness, again, according to the Dharma, is cherishing others. Cherishing others. Remember I talked, the whole purpose of your life, if you're aspiring Buddha, is to be in service to others. But knowing what to do and when to do it. Having the wisdom to know what to do and when to do it. So cherishing others is the source of all happiness. If you cherished others, you wouldn't kill, you wouldn't steal, you wouldn't commit adultery or have harmful sexual relations, you wouldn't lie, you wouldn't slander, you wouldn't speak harshly or waste people's time with frivolous gossip, greed, hatred, and ignorance. It all, you know, if you cherished others, those minds wouldn't as likely arise. So cherishing others is the source of all happiness. So at this point, you do a little sort of a keto move, I guess, or you switch the mind that cherishes others. You mentally imagine, okay, I'm going to give up self-cherishing, and from now on, I'm going to cherish others. I'm going to give up self-cherishing, and from now on, I'm going to cherish others. So it's called exchanging self for others, but it's really exchanging self-cherishing for cherishing others. So we think, okay, when you get up in the morning, you get up for others. You get cleaned up, you try to look nice for others. You eat your breakfast so you can serve others. You drive to work for others. You do your job well for others. You know, you speak respectfully and kindly and have good manners for others and on your whole life. It's like your focus has always been me, now it's like shifting out, it's 180 degrees opposite. Now we live our life for others. It's completely different, but very powerful. Then the next contemplation is sometimes called the supreme wish, and it's this thought, this is really hard to hear for some, you know, it's the first time you hear it, it's really hard to hear this, but just chew on it. It says, I am personally responsible for the happiness of all beings, even the people I don't like. Even those jerks. You know who I'm talking about. We all have people that we just, that rub us the wrong way. You know, just somebody that right now that's annoying you. But even those people, we don't exclude anyone. And this is the Bodhisattva's attitude, this so-called awakening warrior, the Bodhisattva. He or she their only thought is helping others and taking personal responsibility for the happiness of all beings. I am personally responsible for the happiness of all beings throughout all space and time. Of course, it's an attitude, isn't it? It's not, if it were possible, it would have been done by now. But it's an attitude that we need to train ourselves to have. It's the attitude that will give enormous power to our spiritual practice. Because it's antithetical to our worst enemy, which is the self-cherishing mind. And so the next step is called actual generation of bodhicitta, or the awakening mind. It's where we realize, we go, well, wait a minute, I don't even have my act together. How can I help others? Well, I have to get enlightened. I have to set my sight on supreme enlightenment. What is that? That's the elimination of all of my faults and the development of all of my good qualities. And you go, well, I don't have that many good qualities. Well, you have some compassion. It can be grown and expanded upon infinitely. I have some power. It can be grown and expanded upon infinitely. I have some ability to know what to do, so-called skillful means, at the right place and time to help others and make the right decision at the right time. We can grow our ability to do that skillfully. And compassion and loving kindness, all of these positive qualities that we attribute to an enlightened being or a saint, so to speak, we have some of those. And they can be nurtured and grown. And by the same token, our negative states of mind, the one that drag us down, our fears, our anxiety, our depression, our craziness, our, you name it. We have, our arrogance, all the things that cause problems. Greed, hatred, ignorance, pride, and jealousy are the big five, but, we can add to that list. 84,000, in fact, delusions. Those are the things that bring us down, and we have to purify those, and we can do that. Buddhism is amazing, powerful. In fact, Tantra particularly has very powerful ways to uproot these negative mind states, these so-called negative mind states, kleshas, another word, things that disturb our mind. So we want to become enlightened for the sake of others. Why do we want to become enlightened? For the sake of others. Usually we think, I must become enlightened. And then we go, for the sake of others. Kind of like, oh my God, it's like some punishment. We have to do it for others. But really the goal is to help others. And the method to do that is one's own enlightenment. The goal is to help others perfectly. The method to do that is to get enlightened. It's kind of like, you want to be a heart surgeon? Okay, fine. Go get trained. Go get trained. Then you can do heart surgery. You want to help beings, open their heart and experience their full potential? Fine. Go get trained. Work it out yourself. Find the truth. Realize your own inner potentials. Then you can really do the work for other beings like that. So this is the attitude, I must become enlightened for the sake of all beings. It's called bodhicitta, the awakening mind, the open heart, expanding heart. It's so important at the beginning to have this kind of, even if what I'm saying only makes sense and it doesn't really resonate with the way you normally think or believe, even if you can just try to make it happen a little bit in your mind, it's called effortful in the beginning it is. It's effortful generation of bodhicitta. So we do that, you know, we make some effort to generate this mind of enlightenment. And then eventually, with practice and repetition over many years, you know, we can actually become a bodhisattva, where it's every thought 24/7, our whole life is totally dominated by this attitude of the awakening mind. Then you really reach an extraordinary state of being able to help others. And you're a bodhisattva at that point. With this motivation in mind, we'll do the prayers, and then we'll read the foundation of all good qualities, and then time will be up. And I will not have done it what I wanted to, but that's okay. We'll get through this what we need to. So again, I know some people are new here, or I think they are. So you put your hands together if you want to. Almost every spiritual tradition, they do that. You know, they put your hands together at the heart. It's just, I think it helps to come from your heart. You know, when you put your hands here, it kind of makes you, it's also a prostration. You know, this is considered to be, this prostration is just where you hold your hands, and you can do physical prostrations. Like that, you can bow, and then you can do all the way down to the ground prostrations, but this is like a way of paying respect too. So we'll do that, and we'll do the refuge in bodhicitta, and I'll say a few words about that, and then the four immeasurables at the top of the page, and then we'll go to do seven limb prayer and the short mandala offering. And here's the thing, when you do refuge in bodhicitta, those of you who are already Buddhist or wondering if you should be a Buddhist, and nobody should be a Buddhist, it's really up to you. Buddhism is not for everybody. That's kind of good news, isn't it? You don't have to be a Buddhist. The Buddha always said, he said, come and check it out. If it works for you, great. If it doesn't, fine. Move on. You don't need to torture yourself and feel like you have to believe everything. No, it's not like that. So if you, but this is the refuge in bodhicitta. So the first two lines have to do with going for refuge, and the attitude you should have is the first one is like dread. Fear. Dread. Maybe dread's better than fear. But fear's, but what you should be afraid of? You should be afraid of your mind. Like the messes that you could make with a mind like yours between now and the time you die. Like, oh my gosh, you know, this mind is out of control 24/7. I mean, for the most part, I haven't killed anybody, you know, and I try to be a nice person. I try to do the right thing, but, you know, we're all caught up in something called samsara, aren't we? This whole process of uncontrolled causation, and it is going to kick us in the, you know what, if we don't get a handle on it. And so we need to really have some sense of, oh my God, I'm sick. I got a problem. I need to get a handle on this. So So we have to have some sense of dread of the consequences of living with the mind, with the kind of mind we have. And maybe, you know, maybe most of you here aren't crazy. I'm not saying you are. I'm just saying we all live in samsara. And for most of us, I know for me, I can only speak for me. Everybody else is probably enlightened. You're humoring me, giving me something to do on Monday night. Thank you for being here. But like I said, I'm getting something out of this. But so dread of the, you know, sometimes they say fear of the lower realms, but let's just go with what the worst things that could happen to you as a result of a crazy mind, and in confidence that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are reliable sources of refuge. Just like if there was a hailstorm, you'd go to shelter, wouldn't you? If you were in the middle of a big field, you'd want to go find a shelter. Well, if you've checked Buddhism out and you've seen that the enlightened beings and their teachings in the spiritual community really do resonate with you and they make sense and you have confidence and you've actually practiced these things and seen it work. So you don't know Buddhism until you've actually been in a situation where something went wrong and then you went and you caught yourself getting, you were in a situation where you would ordinarily get angry, right? And then you can actually feel the anger beginning to rise, but then you become mindful of it, and you go, then you reach up into your Dharma medicine cabinet, and you pull, with mindfulness, you pull into the moment, I need to let go. I need to let go of my expectations. I need to have some compassion for this person. I need to not create more ick for myself because what goes around comes around. You bring Dharma wisdom into the moment. You solve your problem right then and you don't get upset. Or if you're angry, you're only angry for a minute instead of 2 days, you know? And then you go, wow, that was so great. That's, now you know Dharma. But before that, you've just been reading books. That's called practicing Dharma. That's what I'm talking about. So if you have confidence in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and dread of what life's going to be like with the kind of mind you have, then that's the motivation primarily for taking refuge. And the second two lines, by the merits that I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all beings. That's bodhicitta, isn't it? That's the Mahayana motive that we talk about. This is a Mahayana Buddhist center. So we'll do that. And then the next one has, you know, measurable happiness that has to do with love. And the second one is freedom from suffering, has to do with compassion and then joy and then equanimity. So that's the next prayer. And then we'll talk about the other ones later, maybe. All right, so let's do refuge in bodhicitta. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now, four measurables. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings from the happiness that is free from suffering, and may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Now the seven limb prayer, and each one of these limbs has a meaning. You know, these are not empty rituals, but for example, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind is paying homage, isn't it? And it's an antidote to our ego and our arrogance and our pride. And I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. Generosity is antidote to stinginess and clinging. And then declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning of this time. That's like being honest with yourself, you know, when you've done a bunch of stupid things and you're declaring it, it's a way to purify it. So you purify body, speech, and mind by declaration. Rejoicing in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Rejoicing is an antidote to jealousy. Yeah. Who likes to be jealous? How painful is that? Please remain until the end of cyclic existence. So we're asking the Buddhas to remain. It creates a cause for us to keep getting teachings, turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. And then dedication is has another meaning, which I can't remember right now. But it's a way of sealing the positive potential that we've created so that it goes just toward enlightenment. So we'll do that prayer. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Then we're going to do the short mandala offering. And we do this, those of you who've been around for a while, there's a mudra. So mudra just means, I don't know, there are hand mudras anyway. They're symbols, symbolic. This is a kind of a symbolic representation of the universe. And the center of the universe is Mount Meru. These two fingers, the ring fingers that are sticking up. And then there are four continents, the sun and the moon. So anyway, these are the four continents. So you're holding it at your heart. And it's like you would be willing to give, you know, the entire universe and the sun and the moon for these teachings. That's how much you really want them. You know, that's how much you need them. That's the attitude when we offer the mandala. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha fill and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niyata Yami. So that means I send forth this precious mandala to you, to the gurus. Okay, so we'll do some dedication verses toward the end. And I'd like to read, and then we'll look at a video here in a moment. I'd like for us to read the foundation of all good qualities together. And just a little, you can Google the foundation of all good qualities and find a nice little commentary by this Tibetan, well, he's actually Indian, and he wasn't even a monk, but he was one of the Dalai Lama's teachers. His name is Khuna Lama Rinpoche, and really a great teaching. And but this is a summary of the entire Buddhist path, obviously cryptic, but it covers renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness, and it talks about Tantra. And I'll give a little bit of a commentary about this next week. I don't want to do it today because we'll run out of time. And maybe some of it, you know, those of you who've been studying, you probably... Has anybody memorized it? Good for you. All right, anybody... I was going to offer... No, I'm just kidding. A prize. But now somebody's already memorized it. So no prizes. Actually, the prize is that you memorize it. So now, if you get locked in prison somewhere, you don't have to go find a book. You've memorized the whole path, right? You can sit here, you can meditate, and you know, a lot of the Tibetan monks, when they got locked up in prison, they had memorized thousands of pages of text. So they were just sitting there doing their practices for years and years and years, and not too worried about not having the books with them. Okay. Foundation of all good qualities is the kind and perfect pure guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely upon him with great respect. Understanding that the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once is greatly meaningful and difficult to find again. Please bless me to generate the mind that unceasingly day and night takes its essence. This life is as impermanent as a water bubble. Remember how quickly it decays and death comes. After death, just like the shadow follows the body, the results of black and white karma follow. Finding firm and definite conviction in this, please bless me always to be careful to abandon even the slightest of negativities and accomplish all virtuous deeds. Seeking samsaric pleasures is the door to all suffering. They are uncertain and cannot be relied upon. Recognizing these shortcomings, please bless me to generate the strong wish for the bliss of liberation. Led by this pure thought, mindfulness, alertness, and great caution arise. The root of the teachings is keeping the Pratimoksha vows. Please bless me to accomplish this essential practice. Just as I have fallen into the sea of samsara, so have all mother migratory beings. Please bless me to train in supreme bodhicitta and bear the responsibility of freeing migratory beings. Even if I develop only bodhicitta, without practicing the three types of morality, I will not achieve enlightenment. With my clear recognition of this, please bless me to practice the bodhisattva vows with great energy. Once I have pacified distractions to wrong objects and correctly analyzing the meaning of reality, please bless me to generate quickly within my mind stream the unified path of calm abiding and special insight. Having become a pure vessel by training in the general path, please bless me to enter the holy gateway of the fortunate ones, the supreme Vajra vehicle, that's Tantra. At that time, the basis of accomplishing the two attainments is keeping pure vows in Samaya. As I have become firmly convinced of this, please bless me to protect these vows and pledges like my life. Then, having realized the importance of the two stages, the essence of the Vajrayana, that's Tantra too, by practicing with great energy, never giving up the four sessions, please bless me to realize the teachings of the Holy Guru. Like that, may the gurus who show the noble path and the spiritual friends who practice it have long lives. Please bless me to pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. In all my lives, never separated from perfect gurus, may I enjoy the magnificent Dharma. By completing the qualities of the stages and paths, may I quickly attain the state of Vajradhara. So Vajradhara is sort of the tantric manifestation of the Buddha. Okay, so before I don't want to say any more right now. I want to just let's go ahead and look at this. This is about a 20-minute or so. I'm not sure. It might be 30 minutes. But I looked at it briefly today. I know that John Landau, by the way, is the layperson at the end of this. And John edited this book. And John did the course, the online course that you know that you have a key to it, right? And so he's a Princeton grad, smart guy, and a great guy too. So if we can turn some lights out.
As we mentioned at the beginning of the series, the teachings of the Buddha are vast in scope and profound in their implications. Among the most profound are his teachings on Tantra, also called Vajrayana, based on a foundation of loving kindness, a correct view of reality, and total renunciation. You're tired of life, as you've known it, and you're courageously determined to be free of samsara for the sake of all beings. If that's the case, then the practice of Tantra is for you. Under the guidance of qualified masters, students learn methods such as visualization, deity yoga meditation, and mantra recitation that help transform diluted energy into wisdom, so we can see the totality of who and what we really are. As Buddhist practitioners, it's essential to realize that the highly sophisticated and sensitive techniques in Tantra simply won't work, and even can be highly dangerous unless our motivation is genuinely altruistic, since these precious teachings are extremely difficult to come across in this day and age. Join us in investigating how we can make the most of this extremely rare opportunity.
In this presentation, you're going to hear about the Buddha's most esoteric teachings, those of Tantra. You've also heard that an altruistic motivation is especially important in the case of these teachings. In fact, it's very much like in the fairy tales you may have heard as a child. You know, it's only the most pure-hearted hero who's actually able to free the princess and save the day. And in the same way, it's only the most sincere, altruistic-minded practitioner who is able to succeed in the practice of Tantra. Now, the Buddha said that the fundamental nature of our hearts and minds is purity. We simply have to discover that purity through the veils of our ignorance. And so before listening to these teachings, take just a moment to discover the purity of your own heart and to generate a very strong and determined intention to attain the state of a Buddha through the practice of Tantra in order to be able to bring to enlightenment all other living beings.
The attitude. We can correct our action. Don't think that my attitude, my action is, you know, my previous karma. I cannot do anything. That is misunderstanding of karma. Don't think I'm the powerless. We do have power. Human being, we do have power to change our lifestyle, to change our attitude, to change our habit. That capacity you call maybe Buddha potentiality or God potentiality or whatever you call. That's why Buddhism is simple. Simple. And it is universal teaching. It is understandable for any religious or non-religious people. That is the beauty of human being has a powerful instrument. Any kind of things we can trick, any energy we can trick, we can transform it something else. Oh, that's what Tibetan Buddhism has. Much method how to transform attachment into the path to liberation. How to desire transform it, path to liberation. We do have much emphasis, you know, method. The Buddhist point of view, there is no human problem which is cannot solved by human being, and that personally to understand and to encourage that the entire my problem, I can deal with my problem, I can solve my problem. That attitude is, I think, a very essential for the growth of oneself. I truly believe that all of us, you know, even though we are not good meditators, you know, we are not maybe good spiritual, you know, but all of us, if we have, you know, some understanding and we have encouragement oneself, we can solve the problem. Most time, we lack of, you know, understanding of our own capacity. We put ourselves down. That's why Tibetan Buddhism, sometimes you see Buddha with you. You see yourself as Buddha. I'm sure you, all of you heard that kind of thing.
Tradition of Buddhism, there is a great emphasis on practicing Tantra as the fastest way to achieve enlightenment. Not just to get enlightened quickly, but the reason that the Buddha taught Tantra was taught to bodhisattvas, great bodhisattvas who had unbearable compassion for the suffering of sentient beings, and because of that found it unbearable that it takes three countless great eons to achieve enlightenment, and that while one is becoming a Buddha, sentient beings are suffering all that time. So because of that, the Buddha taught the fast way to achieve enlightenment, the tantric way. So it's meant for bodhisattvas, those beings who have unbearable compassion. So all of Tibetan Buddhism is influenced by the tantric view, and from a tantric point of view, the teacher, the qualified teacher, is the very embodiment of the triple gem of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So it's kind of appropriate to think about this subject in the sense of meeting with a qualified teacher and generating the right relationship to that teacher is a very crucial part of the path to liberation and enlightenment. We need someone who really not simply knows the words of the Dharma, but knows their own mind and has the experience of controlling their mind in a wise and skillful way. And not just a little bit, but the more we want to accomplish, the more qualified the teacher we need. If we want to accomplish a bit with our mind, we only need a teacher who has a little bit of accomplishment. But if we want to achieve enlightenment, we need someone very, very highly qualified. A Buddha, maybe. For someone who is teaching the path to enlightenment through Tantra, then there is a whole set of other qualities that the guru needs. So when in deciding to follow a particular teacher, we should take time to check the qualities of the teacher, try to see if they have these qualities. A real guru is something like an iceberg. Only one-tenth of the ice of an iceberg appears above the water. 9/10 is below the water. So a guru is like that. When we see great beings, we can see many qualities. Even at our level, we can see qualities. What we should try to understand is that that's just a little hint of the actual qualities of a truly realized being.
For practicing Dharma, basically one has a choice of sutric practices or tantric practices. Within the sutric practices, there is the Lam Rim, presented traditionally within the three scopes. It addresses individuals of the small scope, the middle scope, and those of the great scope. Another way to summarize the three scopes of the Lam Rim is to present the three principal aspects of the path. One of our prayers says, may I be able to generate renunciation, bodhicitta, and correct view, and may I be able to complete the two stages of Tantra. So you see straight away in the first line we have mention of the three principal aspects of the path. Then in the second line, there is reference to tantric practices. When we talk about sutric practices, or the sutric vehicle, we call that also the causal vehicle. When we are talking about the tantric practices, we can refer to them as the resultant vehicle. The reason why we call the sutric vehicle the causal one is because what we are stressing is the causes that will bring about the ultimate result. And here, when we talk about causes, we are talking about engaging into the practices of the six perfections. So things such as generosity and ethics and enthusiastic effort and concentration and wisdom and patience. So in the six of them, they actually include method and wisdom, which are the causes that will bring about the result that we are seeking. Now, in Tantra, we are stressing different things, and this is why the name resultant vehicle is used. It is called the resultant vehicle because the way we practice is in a way that is stressing the result. Straight from the beginning, we are looking at the resultant state of enlightenment, and we set that as being our ultimate goal. What we do through practices of Deity Yoga is we try to imitate, we try to visualize, we try to imagine that we have already reached that state and we are practicing. In a sense, we are rehearsing the activities that we would be doing if we were already enlightened. We have four different classes of Tantra. We have action, performance, yoga, and highest yoga Tantra. At each one of those classes of Tantra, when they are presented more or less in four different chapters. The first chapter would be the chapter of empowerment. The second one would be of the vows and commitments that are assumed. The third one is the path that is meditated upon. And the last one would be the presentation of the result that is attained. So we start first with the empowerment, which is the step that opens up the door for the tantric path. In the same way that you enter the house through the door, you enter the tantric path through going through the process of ceremony. And what the ceremony does for you, it authorizes you to be able to listen, to reflect, and to meditate on the various tantric teachings. It's important to make the distinction of different ways of attending a ceremony of empowerment. There will be some people who will be coming and receiving it merely as a blessing, but there are others who will take it as a proper empowerment. Now, what makes the difference? What do we mean by making the distinction between these two? If you think that you are not capable of keeping all the vows and commitments that will follow by taking the empowerment, if you feel that you are not ready to meditate on this path, if you feel that you are not ready to visualize yourself as the deity, then it's best not to take this empowerment. You will still be present at the time of ceremony and receive the whole thing as a blessing. On the other hand, if you decide that you are ready to take these vows and commitments and you are ready to engage in those practices, then you actually request and you will receive the empowerment. And then, of course, you have the obligation of keeping up with the vows and commitments and, of course, your daily practices. So, for action and performance tantra, first of all, the first levels of vows that are assumed by those who are lay people are vows of individual liberation, and these are in the form of the vows of refuge. So these include abandoning the 10 non-virtuous actions. Then on top of that, the vows which are assumed are bodhisattva vows. In the case of action and performance tantra, we are not receiving tantric vows. In the case of yoga and highest yoga tantra, on top of refuge and on top of bodhisattva vows, we also assume the tantric vows. Together with the tantric vows, we assume the commitment of engaging in six-session guru yoga. Now, as the name indicates, there are six sessions of that. It's a practice that is repeated six times during the day, every day. If one is practicing lower tantras, one would have to engage in two distinct stages, which are called yoga with signs and yoga without signs. Within the frame of the practices with signs, what we are doing is we are generating ourselves as the deity, visualizing the deity with all its aspects. Then at the next phase, when we are practicing yoga without signs, we are meditating on the emptiness of all these appearances. What happens with the highest yoga tantra is that we are engaging in practices of generation stage and practices of completion stage. Again, there are two distinct phases, more or less similar practices, but they are given different names. At the stage of generation, again, we are visualizing ourselves as the deity, but at the stage of completion, we are focusing on practices that will be bringing about the purification of the channels, the winds, and the drops. The reason why we do that is because we want to render the three things serviceable. We want to bring about a certain degree of purification and flexibility with the winds and the drops that move within our channels. And the reason for that is that in that way we can actually bring about a general purification of all other aspects of our body, not only improving the health, but also getting closer to this model of perfect existence of the Buddha that we have as a goal. So what we are trying to do in the practice of completion stage is to purify the channels and the winds that flow through them. If we can render those things serviceable, then what we will do is actually, ideally, purify the winds that move through the channels. And if you can change the movement of the winds, that means that you can also change the type of mind that is riding those winds. This is what we are referring to when we use the term completion. We are referring to complete purification and complete serviceability of the winds and the channels. Now, it is important to understand that most of the channels that we have within our own body are not stretched out as they should be. Most of the channels are twisted. Many of them may have knots in them, which means that channels which are restricted like that do not allow a flow of the winds and the substances through them. So it's important to exercise. In the same way that some people like very much to do physical exercise because they know the benefit of those exercises. If you can understand that on a physical level, then take that at the level of completion stage and understand that what you are doing during your daily yoga is to engage in some sort of exercises that will bring about this pliancy of the channels and the winds and the substances. Now, when we talk about tantra, also we use the word mantra, and many times we also talk about secret mantra. Mantra and tantra are used almost as an equivalent. If we look at the etymology of the word mantra, it can be broken down into two words. It means mind protection. And when we talk about those practices, we talk about protection, and it's not only the body and speech that need to be protected. The mind is the one that primarily needs to be protected. If the mind is protected, then the body and speech will automatically, secondarily in a sense, will also be covered by this protection. And what is it that the mind needs to be protected from? Well, it is the sense that we have an ordinary body, an ordinary speech, an ordinary mind. We need to protect ourselves from thinking that we are ordinary. We need to protect ourselves from ordinary appearances and a sensing at those appearances. So this is the protection that we are seeking for through these practices. And finally, we come to the explanation of the last word, secret. When we talk about the mantra or tantra, we mean the secret vehicle. It's called the secret vehicle because those practices need to remain undisclosed. Undisclosed to those who are not suitable to hear about those things. It is said that if you talk about your tantric practices to those who are not ready or are not suitable, they have not been prepared to hear about those things, most probably these people will generate reverse faith, non-faith in those practices, and this is what we are trying to avoid in this situation. As beginners, it makes more sense that we will spend more time on practices of sutra rather than practices of tantra, but that doesn't mean that we will completely abandon tantric practices. It is important to understand that sutra on its own cannot take you very far, and tantra that is not supported by sutra will not end with the right result. So it's important to always unite sutra and tantra and make sure that one complements the other.
Tantra is often presented as something that
afterwards. It's something that's more advanced. In other words, first we study the sutra path, what the Tibetans would call the Lam Rim, the graded stages of the path, and develop certain basic fundamentals, such as what Lama Tsongkhapa called the three principal aspects of the path, the renunciation, the wish and the determination to break free from suffering and limitation, and then the view of emptiness, understanding the true nature of reality, and bodhicitta, developing the warm heart, the dedicated heart, striving for enlightenment to benefit others. So that, in a sense, summarizes the sutra path. So it isn't as if we practice on a sutra level until we're proficient and then we turn to something else. It's that the practice of Tantra allows us to get into those very same areas on a deeper, more meaningful basis. And so for me, Lama Yeshe's introduction to Tantra, it really comes alive for me in a really meaningful way, not so much when it's talking about Tantra itself, but rather the three principal aspects that give it birth, that give it meaning. Many years ago, in the middle of the 70s, so quite a long time before I was working on this book, I did a retreat on Vajrasattva. That's the purification practice, which is considered very important preliminary and an aspect of tantric practice. When it was over, and I had to think back as to what the retreat really was about, it really was about renunciation. Even though I was doing tantric practices and tantric visualizations and so forth, what the retreat actually taught me to some extent was the ordinary way that I live my life, the ordinary ego-dominated way that I live my life, is just totally unsatisfactory. Even when things look beautiful, look pleasant, they may just be, it might just be a disguised form of dissatisfaction and suffering. I don't think the reality of that would have hit me if, at the same time, I wasn't doing other practices which were attempting to kind of purify my vision, concentrate my attention, remove some major obstacles so that I could understand things on a deeper level. So later, when I was working on Lama Yeshe's teachings on Introduction to Tantra, where he discusses this to some extent, you know, that Tantra helps you actually understand sutra topics better, I really felt I understood what he meant, what he was pointing at.
Did the video go through, you know, the whatever they're projecting, streaming? Did the streamers didn't get to see it? Okay. Okay, well, anyway, that video is, it's available in the bookstore. There's all the, you know, there's a whole CD with about 13 videos with the little 25 to 30 minute snippets on each of the topics of discovering Buddhism. I think the main point I wanted to leave, we're almost out of time unless we want to extend the evenings. I always thought that we needed to do that, but probably people have child care and things to deal with, so I think an hour and a half is almost not enough to get really into it. But anybody's hair on fire right now? I need to ask a question. Get a chance to do much meditation tonight, but we'll get plenty of chance. I promise you, we'll get you to the ones that are sitting there. Get your knees before we finish this class. Any questions about anything that you heard? Yeah.
So basically just about the steps that you were talking about earlier.
13 or 16 steps.
Yeah, I guess the module.
Oh, the modules. Yes. Okay, well, you know, Discovering Buddhism is basically 14 modules. You know, one of them is the first one, I think, is mindless potential, and then there's one on karma, and there's one on refuge, and there's one on generating bodhicitta. I don't even have all of them here, but there's lots of modules on each of the key points. And this is your first module, or?
Right.
So anyway, this is kind of like coming into a calculus class. You know, and you don't even know algebra or basic math, but, you know, we can pick it, you know, since I'm not qualified to teach calculus, I'm going to teach it, in a simplistic way, because that's how my mind works. But the point is, I think the point that John was making is that the motivation for, you know, Tantra. Well, first of all, let me go back to the beginning here and say a few things about Tantra. The word Tantra means everlasting continuum, or it really has to do with your mind stream, all the way up to enlightenment. Now, if you go, as John, I listened to the audio of the online course this weekend twice, once down to the beach and one back. What's back from the beach? Anyway, he was talking about Tantra, and he was saying, you know, if you pick up a book and you read about, you know, you start thumbing through, you know, some local magazine, you know, you'll see some course on Tantra, and it usually has something to do with improving your sex life or your intimacy and all that. And that's kind of the pedestrian mentality of, you know, that's where people think. I mean, everybody's probably heard that, right? I mean, that's the word on the street. But if you thought that was what this class was about, now's a good time to leave. But Robbie, you can go ahead. no pillows or anything here. You know, your yoga mats will not be needed for this class. But. As was pointed out, all kinds of attachment, even the attachment of sexual intercourse, all is used as considered to be grist for the mill in Tantra. Tantra doesn't exclude anything. And it wants to work with that energy. And in Hashyoga Tantra, that's actually the energy that a qualified practitioner can work with. But, you know, we shouldn't think that's what, you know, I mean, we're really, from my perspective, as I was preparing for this class, I'm thinking, This is really advanced stuff. And if we can just make some connection with it and see the value of it and create the karmic causes to be able to get more teachings and maybe eventually meet a qualified teacher and maybe have gotten ourselves in a place where we're qualified to practice at that level, great. You know, and then we practice usually. I mean, our teachers have always encouraged us to practice Hatha Yoga Tantra, but we'll do some Kriya, you know, the lowest level of Tantra is Action Tantra. So there are four levels of Tantra, Action, Performance, Yoga, and Hatha Yoga. Well, Hatha Yoga Tantra is the most profound level of Tantra, Kala Chakra being an example. And it's the only way, it sounds like a little bit of a advertisement, but it is. I mean, from the Mahayana Buddhist perspective, the only way to get enlightened is to practice Hatha Yoga Tantra well. Okay? And then there are two levels. Kirti Sanchenpa Rinpoche talked about the generation stage and the completion stage. And the completion stage is the ultimate, where we can purify the energies of the mind, the psychic energies. And he talked about channels and drops and so forth. And those of you who know, you know, Chinese medicine or even yoga, you know, we talk about the channels where these energies need to be purified. And so Hatha Yoga Tantra has really special techniques for doing that. But let's back up, because John Lindau made a very good point, and it's what I really wanted to touch on tonight, and I've got a few minutes to do it. But the points are that the foundation for Buddhist practice of Tantra is generating renunciation, you know, which is, Rami Ishii calls it, you know, emerging, you know, but it's just, it's sometimes translated differently. It's, you know, Alex Burson translates it definite emergence. I don't like that translation. But it's like this, it's the determination to be free. It's like having some sense that as I was saying earlier, that we are caught in a cycle of death and rebirth on one level, but even day to day, we're cycling. You know, we're just, same things are happening over and over again. We take our past, most of us, take our past, throw it in front of us and walk right back into it. We do the same things over and over again. You know, we keep marrying the same person, or two or three divorces later, you know, we go, what's going on here? You know, we have to see ourselves as sick. We have to see ourselves as having a problem, as being literally out of control. You know, the first teachings of the Buddha was the so-called the Four Noble Truths. The first one was, all worldlings are deluded. I mean, and that's us. He's saying all ordinary people are deluded. We're deluded. Why? Because we don't see reality. You know, so we create all kinds of suffering for ourselves. Sickness, old age, birth, sickness, old age, and death are just the big things. What about the satisfaction? We're never satisfied. We can never have enough of anything. We get everything we want. The perfect spouse, the perfect job, we want more, 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 more. Lama Zopa says it's the worst suffering in samsara. It's like radiation. It's like, you know, being at Chernobyl, you know, and just being eaten up by this constant, gnawing, dissatisfied mind. We're never satisfied. And we, you know, so that even the good things in life don't last. Nothing lasts. Everything is impermanent. So we're never satisfied. We cling to things, wanting them to last, the relationships to last, the pleasure to last, the job to last, the beautiful sunset to last. We, unconsciously, we cling all the time in a world that's changing. Suffering. That's called suffering. Even though it sounds a little harsh, it's called dissatisfaction. And we have to see that. You know, sometimes we call it the suffering of suffering, the suffering of change, and even pleasure changes into suffering. It doesn't last. And then we have, and this is the hardest one to see, but those of you who did Robbie's class on samsara and nirvana realize that, hey, we're just like a magnet for problems, aren't we? They're just queuing up tomorrow to the next day. You're going to have problems. And are you ready to handle the biggest ones, which are getting old, getting sick, and facing your death? We all get to see that. We all have to deal with our impermanence, and we don't even want to think about it. Death, oh, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to think about it. And it's inevitable. And there's a way to approach death with dignity and clarity. And Tantra has some amazing methods to teach us how to do that. So so we really have to develop a sense of like wanting to get out. He calls it definite emergence. But to do that, you have to have some, it's sort of like, why would you point out all this suffering if there was no way to get out? Otherwise, you'd just be making everybody depressed, wouldn't you? So the point is, you have to have some confidence that it's possible to get out. You have to have some sense of the innate purity of your mind, that you could actually stop your own suffering. And a lot of times we don't have that confidence. We don't feel like we have the potential to stop our own suffering. And this is where I think other people who practice, you know, friends and particularly the guru, the teacher. You meet somebody like Geshe Gelug. I really think that meeting extraordinary human beings like Lama Zopa and Geshe Gelug and people who've been practicing for their whole lives and have a sense of natural joy and spontaneity and almost like a child, that kind of attitude, gives us confidence that, hey, I want what he's got, kind of thing. So renunciation, again, this determination to be free of what? Suffering. To emerge or be free from suffering. That's step one. It's like if you're vomiting up blood and you keep going, there's nothing wrong with me, I'm fine. You know, you won't seek a solution, will you? So it's just like that. You've got to see you're sick. You've got to have some sense of the fact that we have a problem. Okay, that's number one. Number two, I already talked about it, bodhicitta. We did a pretty long meditation on that. It's completely antithetical to self-cherishing, isn't it? The opposite of our biggest enemy, which is self-cherishing, is this bodhicitta attitude. So important. Tantra practice with an egocentric attitude turns us, we become, instead of Luke Skywalker, or what his name is? Anyway, Darth Vader. You know, Darth Vader was a tantric practitioner who was motivated by self-cherishing. You know, not by cherishing others, not by bodhicitta. So it's really important to have that compassionate attitude. Then the third one is the correct view of reality. Now see, you don't go, in a Buddhist center, you don't go, you don't do that when flies go around. You just kind of shoo them away. You don't do that outside either if you think about it. Because you don't want to come back as a fly. But anyway. And then the last point is the correct view of reality. And that is, Robbie's already talked about that, so I don't have to say anything about it. But, you know, it's the correct view of reality. It's seeing things as they are. It's seeing the world truly as it is. Not, as Lama Yeshe says, right now, what we're doing is we have done a glorified paint job on reality. He said, literally, we have painted reality with our projections. And it's not the truth. But we believe it. This is the problem. It's one thing to paint a vision of the world. But then to believe that vision of the world is actually the way it is the source of all of our problems. That's called an ignorance. It's a misknowing. It's not a lack of knowledge. It's not a lack of, like, what's the square root of 532? That's something we can figure out. But this is like, we don't see reality. We misperceive reality. And so the wisdom of emptiness that Buddhism is talking about is doing stripping away our projections and seeing things as they are. And when we have that wisdom of seeing things as they are, naturally compassion and loving kindness and all the good qualities that we innately have emerge. and have a chance to flourish. But as long as we're shut down by our belief in a self-existent I that's the center, I'm so important, and I've got to have what I want, and anybody that insults me becomes instant enemy, you know, and I got to have we're addicted to pleasure, aren't we? I want everything that's delicious, and I don't want anything that's not fun or that gives me a hard time or anybody. You know, it's the same thing. It's attachment, isn't it? I'm attached to pleasure, and I'm attached to not having anything unpleasant, a.k.a. aversion. Aversion is just a negative attachment. So that's our mind. All day long, up, down, samsara. So, you know, until we get to the root of it, the problem, the tap root of our self-centeredness is this misknowing of reality, particularly starting with ourselves. We have a really distorted view of ourselves. So Tantra, this is a very cool part of Tantra. You have to understand emptiness a little bit. You don't have to have a perfect understanding or an appreciation of renunciation. You have to have a taste of it. You have to have some feel for it intellectually. You don't have to have a perfect experience of bodhicitta, just a feel for it. And you don't have to have a perfect understanding of emptiness, but a feel for it. If you can do that, if you feel like you have that much, then come back next week. And if you don't, get it. Because that's really what you need to get in the door of Tantra. You don't, and Tantra, as John Landau was pointing out, it actually, I have some friends, and they did a 4-year retreat on Tantra, using high sugar tantric techniques. And they came out, they were husband and wife. They didn't talk to each other for 4 years. They didn't have sex either, by the way. But they were in two little huts, side by side, for 4 years. And when they came out, and they did this up at Milarepa, and I went up there right after they finished their retreat, and I was talking to them because I've known them for a long time, and I said, "What did you get out of it?" And they said, "The Lam Rim, Tantra just deepened and deepened and deepened my appreciation and experience of the teachings of the three principal aspects of the path. It just made that so much richer." So don't think we're going to leave behind the three principles of the path. They'll be with us forever. And that's really what makes Buddhism or this whole tantric path work, is having the stronger our foundation in the three principal aspects, the more qualified we are to practice tantra, and the more benefit we can get from it. So, if you have questions, I will stick around for a couple of minutes. I'll stay along. It ran as long as I need to, really. But if you have questions, please stick around. I'm giving you these three pieces of paper. I would like for you to bring these back next week. The homework is a little bit... this is actually from a class when I did this 4 years ago. And the homework, but it's still relevant. So if you'd read The Foundation of All Good Qualities, if you get Lama Yeshe's book, and I encourage you to buy it, read, you know, up to page 56. And then there's the readings. Again, if you're doing the course, the readings are in that, in the course material, for discovering Buddhism. Then I handed out a meditation that Lama Yeshe used to give a lot of beginners, at Kopan, back in the day. And so it's called a Duma meditation. It's actually beginning to work with some of the blissful energies that you can generate with your mind. So you get to see that you can generate a blissful, happy mind that's independent of some external object. You can generate amazingly pleasant, pleasurable experiences without depending on something else. It's kind of interesting to have to pay attention to that. So if you want to do that Duma practice, please do that. If you're up for it, memorize the foundation, but at least read The Foundation of All Good Qualities every day. And then the enrollment key for Introduction to Tantra, if you want to do the online course. If you really want to go for it, just do all of this. This would be so cool to do it all, if you really want to go for it.
Is it IE or EI?
Deity, I think, is EI.
Oh, you have IE up there. What's
the one? Oh, it's DEI.
We'll try both.
Pardon?
We'll try both.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's EI. I don't know. I have a hard time spelling it, obviously. Okay, so let's take 1 minute to just sit in this. We've gone over a few minutes, and I apologize. Actually, maybe we should extend this class. Yeah. Do you want to, the quizzes for the online course?
Yeah.
If you can do that, awesome.
I mean, for everybody.
Yeah, that'd be great to take the online quizzes. Very good. Very good. Yeah, I mean, I took the first quiz the other day. It's very good. It's a nice review. It keeps your mind, makes you think about the material a little bit more. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. All right, so just take a minute. This is, there's a lot of things to think about. And I don't want you to be overwhelmed by this. It's really, you just go at your own pace. That's really the point of it. And, just allow all the words to just settle and digest for just a minute. So we want to, individually and collectively, we created something called merit. And merit equals happiness. If you really want to know what the cause of happiness is, it's merit, good karma. And we've created that tonight individually and collectively. So we want, we want to dedicate that merit to the happiness of all beings, and specifically tonight, I'd like for you to dedicate the merit to the health and long life of Lama Zopa Rinpoche, our teacher, our spiritual guide. Okay, thank you for your attention. And again, I'm serious. If you have a question, I'll stick around for as long as I need to.